Do you like sports? Do you like art? What about science? Giraffes? Giraffe scientists that paint rugby games? It's all available on Audible, the biggest audiobook site with the largest selection of audiobooks this side of the inner solar system. No need to use your boring old eyes anymore. The ears are the future, my friend. Why, you're using them right now. So check out Audible and get your listen on. Go to www.readlearnlivepodcast.com/audible to start your 30-day free trial today.
I guess I'm still a romantic, and I still believe that we are very influenced by our love for others, and that it's not the case that you can just go through the world without being affected by your love for other people or their love for you. I like the idea that you can be wrecked by your heartbreak, and so I guess this is all maybe romantic and a little doomy.
Hello and welcome to Read, Learn, Live, the podcast about improving yourself through literature. I'm your acclaimed host, John Monaster, and I'd like to welcome you to episode 72, otherwise known as the year Pong was released and today's modern video game revolution began. As always, if you have ideas for books you'd like to see featured or have authors you want to put me in touch with, you can reach me at jon@readlearnlivepodcast.com. Today, I'm delighted to have the opportunity to speak with author Liz Harmer about her book, The Amateurs. Liz Harmer is a Canadian writer living in Southern California with her many pets, three children, and philosopher husband. Her stories, essays, and poems have appeared or are forthcoming in The Walrus, Image Journal, The Globe and Mail, The Malahat Review, Lit Hub, and elsewhere. In 2014, she won gold in personal journalism at the National Magazine Awards after being awarded the Constance Rook Award for Creative Nonfiction. In 2018, she was a finalist for the Journey Prize, as well as appearing in Best Canadian Stories. Her debut novel, The Amateurs, released in 2018 with Knopf Canada, was a finalist for the Amazon Canada First Novel Award. I hope you enjoy our conversation as much as I did. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Read, Learn, Live podcast in March 2020. I am so excited to be joined today by author Liz Harmer. Liz, say hello.
Hello.
Hello. Thanks for joining me. I'm so glad I got a chance to read your book, The Amateurs. As soon as I saw the cover, I was intrigued and read the book a little bit by the cover and then read the whole book itself, and it was even better. So really, really curious and interested to talk with you about this one because it's pretty interesting. Just to kick things off, I always just like to ask the author, like in your own words, just tell us about the book. What's it all about?
The Amateurs, I guess I'm calling it a book of technological rapture in which a Silicon Valley megalomaniacal billionaire invents portals and then sends them out into the world before all the kinks are worked out. And then everybody buys one. And then everybody disappears and nobody can get back and they don't know where everyone's gone to. So it's kind of a strange post-apocalypse with a multiverse element.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay. I like that. Succinct. So I'll ask a couple quick creative questions because I'd like to know a little bit about that. And then we can hop into the actual book and its content and what it means and
sure.
You know, how perhaps it's connected to our world today. I think like most good fiction, of course it is. So anyway, I was just curious. I mean, I'm sure this took quite a long time to put together and thought, and I always like to know about sort of the germ of the idea, you know, like where did this book come from and why did you decide now was the time to write it?
Oh, well, it came from a couple of things coming together at once. So one thing that happened was I was writing a short story. I don't usually work in a speculative vein. I usually work in domestic realism. I really like sort of just basic human psychology kind of stories. But my husband is a philosopher. He's a philosophy professor. And one of the things he works on is philosophy of the infinite. He works on Leibniz and is very interested in Star Trek. So I have an interest in science fiction, but it wasn't something I was practicing. And I had this idea for a story, partly born out of an idea that I was going to do something in my life that I would terribly regret, and I'd want to be able to have a do-over. And so I was imagining myself, you know, screwing up my marriage, and then that becoming a huge regret, and then 10 years later, suddenly there are time machines available. And so I wrote this very sad little story that opens with this phrase: "So much depends on technology. What if you could just go back in time?" And so I wrote this kind of like whimsical story, and it's a very lonely story because what happens is she goes back and ends up having an affair with her ex, but her previous self is there, like, being betrayed. So it's confusing and strange story. It's called Many Maries. So Marie became this character. And then the other thing that was happening was I was like fantasizing about a good life where we weren't so, I don't know, our lives weren't so dominated by not only technology, but like our consumer habits, by the environmental catastrophe, by, you know, all the demands of capitalism. And I just thought, like, what if we could just all hang out and have a nice time together and like forage for food and like, I don't know, smoke pot and sleep in and eat pizza together. I don't know. Like, I was just having this like fantasy of a good life. So it was partly like a wish fulfillment. Right. You know, what if all that stuff disappeared, like commerce and the government? And it was just like a happy apocalypse, you know? And then I was sort of, I thought I would write it as a play. I'm like, maybe I'll just like invent this portal and like it'll all take place in Marie's apartment. It'll be like this play that only takes place in this apartment. You'd hear from outside. And I started writing that. And I very quickly was like, I'm not a sci-fi writer. I can't write about portals. And then it was my husband who said, like, no, this is a good idea. Like, you should keep trying to write this. So so that was all of the things coming together at the beginning.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. I like that phrase you said. I think you said something like, you don't practice science fiction. Made it sound like a religion or something.
Right.
But as a fellow Star Trek enthusiast, I hope that your husband has been enjoying Picard. Certainly interesting. But anyway, that's really interesting story of how this came to be. And especially when you said that it wasn't, you know, speculative fiction or science fiction wasn't normally what you wrote. I mean, to some degree, I think you could hand this to someone, this book to someone that said, as the type of person that would say, I don't read science fiction.
Right.
And they would be fine with it, you know, because it's not a kind of book where science fiction is integral to the story and plot. You know, you need to understand science. You need to be able to, you know, it's just sort of there. But even the ports, which we'll get into, they're very, you know, hard to figure out. They don't seem quite science-based to some degree, you know? So I think that's an interesting thing. And I think that is, I'm almost rethinking large parts of what I read now in light of what you said also in terms of your personal connection to it. It's very interesting to me, but we can talk through that. So anyway, okay. So you jumped around between these different styles. You had a short story, you were trying to write a play, all this stuff, and you settled on a novel. So how did you actually get to the novel as it is now? What sort of was your process? What works for you to write?
I'm definitely a person who writes by the seat of my pants. So I just started writing scenes. The first versions of this had, the idea was that people could come, leave and come back very easily. And so it was an idea that there were a few people that weren't going to participate. So like the people in the book who are all left behind, we're never going to go through, but everyone else was kind of like, you would get like a visitation from someone and they'd be dressed in like, I don't know, like Mr. Darcy, like dressed like Mr. Darcy or something. Then you'd have like a fun affair and then Mr. Darcy would leave again. And, so I had this, that was the conception at first. And so I was writing a lot of scenes like that. To me, there was always like a love story, like obsessive element. And then, I also wrote like about 50 pages where, the group is just hanging out and that there wasn't much plot. And I realized like this won't be sustainable through an entire novel. But the main thing was that I was writing this, it's not the first novel that I finished, but it's the first novel that I feel like that's not stuck in a drawer. But what I needed to do, I actually had a mentor that I worked with. I was doing a master's degree at University of Toronto. And he helped me figure out how to move from the place where I get stuck sometimes, which is just feeling around in the world and like getting obsessed with the characters and not necessarily moving the plot forward. Because he gave me permission to jump to Silicon Valley. So like, I had thought I was going to set the entire thing in this town, which is based on Hamilton, Ontario, where I'm from in Canada. Mm-hmm. I thought the whole thing was going to be stuck there in Marie's kind of community. And at a certain point, like all of the characters are not actors. They're all very passive. They're all kind of waiting to see what will happen. It's hard to build a plot around people like that. So when I was able to move to Silicon Valley, give myself permission to portal through these different sections because of my mentor, that's how I was able to finish it.
Mm. Yeah. That's an interesting sort of creative block that you were able to overcome.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine how that'd be difficult. And knowing that, I mean, we have parts of the story where it is sort of like that. And even the characters seem kind of self-aware. You know, they have this conversation like within the novel where they have these conversations and people are like, we're having the same discussions over again.
Yeah.
We're not going anywhere. And, you know, we're waiting for a leader. And, you know, they have leader figures that kind of come and go maybe. And yeah, I think that's an interesting point. But anyway, okay, let's hop into the book a bit and start talking about these people.
Sure.
And at the beginning, you know, with this first group, the amateurs, there's really a connection in terms of place, I think. And that's true throughout the book. I think the book is in a large part a discussion about place. But, you know, with this particular group, there's a lot of disagreements about where to go. This sort of, this Philip or Philippe wants to go and wants to, you know, head south and not deal with the winter. Marie wants to stay and it's her home. And I don't know, I guess it really made me think about, you know, what I would do in that situation and, you know, whether I would want to stay or go. And I think it's tricky to say, cause I grew up in Los Angeles and I live in New York now. Mm-hmm. So this isn't quite the home I've known forever, but I think there is definitely many situations you've seen where people will stay places where they probably shouldn't, mm-hmm. or will stay places within uncertainty just because it's home and they don't know anything else. And, you know, I had that example of, you know, flood victims that repeatedly rebuild their homes over and over again, even knowing that they're on a floodplain and it's likely it'll happen again, but they want to be resilient. And I was just curious if you had any, like in putting these characters together and thinking about this, if you had any thoughts about why we do that, why is this idea of home so important to us and why we feel like it can be so hard to leave sometimes?
It's really interesting because I think I was writing a very, so I was feeling very homesick because I had just moved to California and I had lived in Hamilton, Ontario my whole life when I was writing. And, I was, because I got married very young. So I got married when I was 22, we were still in university, and had children starting in my mid 20s and really didn't have the means by which to travel or have like big adventures like everyone else seemed to be having. And the idea, I felt like there was an idea that like sophisticated people would like travel the world and, you know, live in interesting cities and like move around. And I was living in like, you know, a kind of a city that has often been treated like a ridiculous place to live. Like it's a steel town. Why would anybody stay there? And so actually what I was feeling was a rebelliousness, I first of all felt like you can make a home anywhere. You can make a home with the people that you're with. And there's something beautiful to me about people who are willing to invest in the place they're in and the community that they're in. That felt to me like a very important value. It was partly that like I felt, you know, that I was being treated like a rube or something because I hadn't had these like sophisticated experiences. Whereas, you know, I'm a person with a mind and a rich inner life, and I want to be able to value like a sense of place and like a sense of rootedness, which I think is, anyway, I don't know if this is sort of maybe veering into like a discussion of class or something.
I think it's all connected.
Yeah. It's all connected, right?
I mean, people that are wealthier can move around more easily and or they buy second, third, fourth homes.
Right.
I mean, their idea of home is very different.
Yes. Probably. Yeah. And so, and then for many of us, you know, if a disaster hits, like, where are we going to go? You know? And I was also thinking a lot about like sort of an anxiety loop that I get into, which is, you know, the sunk cost idea, or like you've already stayed this long, you know, You've invested this much. Are you really going to leave now? And so sometimes people get attached in a sort of with a gambling paradox or whatever, like they're afraid to leave because they've already spent so much on the place they're in. So those are two sort of sides. One is negative and one is positive about staying.
Yeah. Yeah. And then to connect that with the portals, the ports, which is sort of the way for people to escape, right? If people do this, and you know, initially it's interesting in the initial beginning of the book, I was sort of wondering like, are we ever really going to know about anything about the ports? Are they just going to be kind of dangled because there's different ways to approach it, right? As a writer, but we start to find out more and more about them and they become more and more sinister, maybe depending on your point of view as the book goes on. But at the beginning, definitely we find out that people just left, you know, they did leave for whatever reason and they did decide. And, you know, that's just interesting to me also. You know, I wonder the extent we find out as we found out more and more that the portals kind of were maybe drawing people in to a degree. I started to wonder, well, what if they weren't, right? Like, would it be any different or not, you know, in the sense that, you know, which is like how much are we responsible for our addictions versus how much are our addictions responsible? And, you know, obviously there's a lot of research that goes into, you know, how to addict people to smartphones as much as possible or whatever, right? There's definitely efforts to or gambling machines or whatever else, right, to make things more addictive. But, you know, there's back and forth there. And so I thought about that for a little bit about, you know, whether what humanity have left if portals weren't so much calling to them. So I guess with that in mind, I mean, how do you think we could, we think about that sort of technology today and I don't know, how do you think people would deal with that type of technology generally? I mean, do you imagine that what you wrote in the book would actually happen today if that sort of thing rolled out?
I've been asking myself this question a lot too, because I've been trying to, to pitch this in a new way and thinking about like the sort of the ludicrousness of this concept in some ways. And then also like realizing that I had gone through this cycle as I was writing, like on the one hand, what you would have is, first of all, the corporation's lying to you. You think you can come back. So you think you can go in and you can come back. And that's the sort of premise by which you're living. And, you know, I'm thinking about this also in terms of contagion now, obviously, because of the COVID-19 stuff. But it takes a little while to figure out everyone's not coming back, right? You'd have to collaborate, share knowledge. You know, not knowing that someone hasn't come back doesn't necessarily mean they aren't coming back. And it would take a while to sort of land on the fact that nobody can come back. By that time, you know, a huge wave of people are gone. So I was, and then when all the people are gone and the grid starts to go down and things become a little more difficult and then it becomes more tempting. So I think there is an argument to be made that without the seductiveness of the ports, that they could probably have a pretty drastic effect on population. You know, that there's like this, you know, desire to leave versus desire to go somewhere, like just desire to not be in this world. Like it's a struggle to live without technology and running water and all your friends and family.
I mean, to struggle to live generally, I think, for a lot of people. And so, yeah, I think just stripping those away even further would really make it difficult. And you can start to get into people's minds and understand why they might make choices like that.
Right. To me, the important thing is that the port has seduced Doors, who's the CEO of the company that produces the ports. To me, that's really an essential thing, that he needs to be seduced and kind of sinister, because otherwise he wouldn't have, I mean, I would hope that he wouldn't have released such a thing, but.
Yeah. And that, of course, that connection, I mean, talk about Doors and his company and being the leader. I mean, that also made me think about tech companies and all sorts of companies in general that are doing, like, I don't know, like Juul, you know, these companies that are releasing products that are clearly addictive. And it's like, are you know, what are these people doing? You know, you would hope that there are not people in the world whose sole goal is to cause harm to people. You know, to some degree, maybe there are. But I wonder, you know, it makes you wonder, like, what these people are seduced by. You know, is it a drive for money? power, mm-hmm. prestige, status, you know, all these things. And is it kind of leading people to push things to no end on them? So, yeah, I wonder if even it takes like a port, this sort of AI, other mind, other universe thing to seduce someone. Or again, if doors could have just been seduced by the same things that seduce CEOs now that are putting things out there.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I come up against my own optimism and my own faith in other humans to think, I don't think I would do that. What would it take for me to become that sort of monstrous CEO? Yeah. And yet here we are with people, you know, being very unethical and very corrupted, and we're trapped in their sort of world now. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I want to, you know, take a little bit of a deeper dive into some of the characters. And we just talked about Doors, but I want to talk about Marie because obviously she's pretty integral to the whole story. She is sort of the main character. And you take a little bit of time to dive into her backstory. So maybe just talk about Marie and who she is and how her experiences shaped her, and especially her time with Jason.
Right. So Marie is... had been kind of an artist with some ambition to be an artist of her in her own right. And her relationship with Jason, which is modeled not very intensely strongly on my relationship with my husband, but there are similarities because she's with somebody who was going to be a physicist, then became a philosopher. I mean, this is very close to my husband's profession. And I was going to be an artist. And there was this time in our marriage where we lived in an apartment very similar to the one in the book. So I'm not saying this autobiographical, but there are like sort of superficial similarities. And, I was really interested in the idea that, I guess I'm still a romantic and I still believe that we are very influenced by our love for others, and that it's not the case that you can just go through the world without being affected by your love for other people or their love for you. I like the idea that you can be wrecked by your heartbreak. And so I guess this is all maybe romantic and a little doomy. So Marie wants to be an artist and kind of can't get it together to do that, partly because there's something embarrassing about ambition or like trying too hard or something. There's like there's an ironic and kind of like self-protective way that she is. Meanwhile, I think that the conflict in their marriage becomes that Jason is ambitious and Jason wants he does want that like sophisticated life. What happens, divorced, and she opens an art supply store, which is based, on an art supply store in Hamilton, which I loved and wished I owned. So I just gave it to Marie. she becomes an entrepreneur instead and somebody who's invested in community in a different way, as a small business owner. And then it's like, Jason ends up marrying someone else, but they end up back in an affair together. Sort of dark side of the romantic life, I guess. And then he leaves without saying goodbye. So he leaves through a port, presumably, and hasn't said goodbye to her. So she's kind of stuck waiting for him. And that's Marie's story. But she's also making new friends, and she has a dog, and she's learning how to shoot, and she's becoming a different, more fierce version of herself. So I think she's a complicated person who I thought her personality was like mine, but I had so little self-awareness that she actually is nothing like me, but I thought I was writing a character like myself, but I think, but actually she's not that much like me.
You're not out there shooting deer.
Nope.
Okay. Yeah. I thought that was really interesting that it seemed like she grew and changed so much. I mean, I guess we would all have to grow and change so much in this type of situation, but that, yeah, she picked up a gun and she, you know, she really became very strong, and you know, other people want to leave, and she would argue fiercely for staying, her voice mattered. And you know, to some degree, it made me think about the idea of kind of the hero within us, where there's there's that story told over and over again of, you know, the call to action and the hero rising to the occasion, and you know, all of us have that potential. And
right.
And it's interesting to me to think about, you know, I wonder, you know, how can we think about maybe like activating that? Like, you know, hopefully we'd be able to find that in ourselves in some way that doesn't require a crisis,
right.
You know,
right.
and to be able to exercise our abilities in the everyday. I mean, do you get a sense that that's something that you try and do or others try and do? Or how can we think about, you know, finding like our inner badass, I guess, for lack of a better phrase?
I actually do think that we can find that. Inner badass is a nice way to put it. You can find out that you're good at things you didn't know you were good at as soon as you see a need, you know, you can meet that need.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. And for me, I think a lot of that is also choices that we make. Mm-hmm. And you know, maybe if you don't have time to organize a march or something like that, you can also just start making choices differently, mm-hmm. and encouraging others to do the same, whether it's what you buy, where you go, you know, all those sorts of things do have impacts, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, well, let's think about some of the other big characters. So, you know, when we moved from the amateurs to the professionals, and we started to get a connection to Doors, who is this kind of crazed cult leader-ish person that everyone, you know, falls in line with, and we sort of get introduced to Brandon, who's our other main character, and he's sort of his right-hand PR person that's always been there and is sort of under the spell of Doors. But it seems like that quickly kind of withers away. So, you know, who is Brandon, and how is, it seemed like there was this sort of rapid rise, you know, and then even faster descent from, you know, the connection to Doors and the company and to everything that was happening. And, you know, what type of person would find themselves in that situation where they sort of connected themselves to this person and then were able to have the mental fortitude that so many others didn't to unplug and disconnect and finally get out?
I think that Brandon is probably more like how I am, which is that very enthusiastic at first, really quick to jump in to something. I don't know what's going on. Very maybe easily convinced by somebody's strength. And then, but also like, so I have like a sort of enthusiastic gullibility, let's call it. But I also have a very strong skeptical streak, so that it's never lasting. Like, I'm not very good at sticking with, you know, I'm good at jumping in, and then I'm also good at questioning and then jumping back out. So I think there's something about his, I mean, there's a way of looking at it that's actually like a form of like over-flexibility, gullibility, weakness. But it's also the flexibility is the thing that allows you to step back and say, no, maybe I don't want to join a cult that's ruining the world, you know?
Yeah.
So I feel like it's a very complicated way to exist, but I think, I don't know, the more I'm thinking about it, it's more the way I am. So when I'm calling Brandon, you know, like a puppy of a man, it's like, well, I'm a puppy of a person myself. So, yeah, I don't know.
I mean, I think we all are to some degree. Like, we want, I think most people, given the opportunity, will be trustful.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I think this is, I forget where I read this, but I feel like I was reading some psychology stuff or something that was sort of like, this is what enabled humanity to be successful. Mm-hmm. Like, if we had intense distrust of everyone all the time, like, we could never really work in groups. We could never do things together. Like, it'd be very difficult to succeed as a species. So we tend to trust by default.
Right.
But it's sort of like that trust but verify, you know, and I think that's a good point. And perhaps not everyone has tuned in quite as much to that. And maybe there's a scale, and it can be hard sometimes to know whether you're too far down the trust, you know, and need to rebalance a bit. So I think that makes a lot of sense. And I find myself somewhat similar to that too.
Yeah. And I mean, no one, I don't want to be in charge. I would like somebody who's better than me, smarter than me, and stronger than me to like tell me how to live. I don't want to have to always make all of those decisions. You know, it would be nice if I could rely on someone else. Unfortunately, that's the kind of thing that a strong person can exploit in others, you know, so yeah.
Totally. Maybe let's think about some of the people that surround Brandon, mm-hmm. right, at the company. And what's the name? I'm forgetting. I'm blanking on the name of the company. Pina, yeah. Right. Pineapple.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So at Pina, right, there are all these people that are kind of surrounding Brandon. There's this inner circle that Doors has, and, you know, there's been friendships and sexual liaisons happening between people. And, you know, I guess I'm curious, like, who are these other people that are sort of sucked in and don't end up leaving? Because it seems like Brandon thinks about them a little bit here and there, mm-hmm. after he leaves, but not so much. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. It makes me wonder, you know, to what extent are the people that we are close with, that we think are our friends, maybe especially people that we work with and see every day because we work with. But you know, how much time would we actually spend with them if we weren't working with them? And how much are we, you know, being willing to change our you know, bar for friendship because of necessity? You know, that, I think that's sort of what that part of the book reminded me of.
Yeah, you end up stuck with like a very smaller group of people than, and yeah, you're stuck with your coworkers, the people that you were competing for scraps of attention from the boss. You know, you were competing with them, you know, a couple of years ago, and now you're stuck eating on compostable plates in the beer garden that stuck doing yoga, stuck seeing them every single day. You know, Brandon's really irritated with this one particular person, Dawn, who seems like she's still too corporate, like too uptight. It's like, get over it, Dawn, the world's over, you know? So there's like, there are these like little workplace irritations. He's frustrated with Zara, who he was in love with and who is so impenetrable to him. So there's all this like just basic human drama still happening, right? I think it's funny to imagine the people you would be stuck with, funny and kind of terrifying. And also the fact that we can kind of figure out how to have community intergenerationally, and like, you know, I mean, it's not intergenerational at Pina, but it is in Hamilton in the, right, in the Marie group. Yeah.
So Philippe is the sort of the, maybe the semi-leader of the initial group that we start with, and he is seduced by the port, mm-hmm, and he eventually goes into the port and leaves. And so this is the first moment, and we sort of get to this point in the book where we actually get to see what it's like inside the port, which was, I was so curious to know, like, are we ever going to find out? You know, I don't know. Have you ever seen a movie called Ronin?
No.
With Robert De Niro, does that ring a bell?
No. Oh, I've heard that movie.
It's a great movie. But anyways, there's like a case that everyone cares about the entire time. And I'm like, are we ever going to find out? And of course, no, you never find out what was in the case. So the point is like, it's not important.
Right.
It was the characters around that. But it's an interesting corollary. But anyway, so we do get to find out here. And, you know, Philippe's in this strange dream world. And he starts to figure out, you know, what's time period. He's in the middle of a war, there are soldiers, he starts to figure this out. But, you know, he sees this business card he brought with this message from, you know, his friends back home, because they somehow realized that maybe there was some amnesia or something going on. And so I don't know, just talk about what that was like. You know, what's it like inside one of these ports? What's happening? What is this? And what does he eventually realize about what's happened to him?
So my idea was that how the ports worked was that, I mean, I guess it doesn't matter. I was like, this is a spoiler. It doesn't matter. We're in there. The way the ports work is that they kind of seamlessly insert you into this other timeline. So you believe you've been there all along. And I was thinking a lot about like Brain in the Vat or like Matrix kind of stuff how do we know that we're not in a simulation? That I feel genuinely plagued by this question at times in my life. So I was thinking of amnesia as an interesting way to write also, like how our mind works in terms of like what we perceive, how we perceive things that we don't understand. I like amnesia literature as a genre. I think it's really interesting and often shows up in sci-fi. I mean, I had a mental health crisis when I was quite young. I'm writing about it right now. And it had to do with like your interpretation of reality, like your knowledge that you're real. These are just questions that are interesting to me. And the other thing that, so he ends up in this kind of World War II France. And I just was obsessed with the movie Saving Private Ryan, in high school. Which is a very strange masculine kind of thing to be obsessed with as a young girl who was from a Christian school, but I wanted something to live for and die for, and I wanted something meaningful. And it felt like this like very glamorous version, or this like somehow romanticized version of that. And I wanted to play with that and be interested in this question of be careful what you wish for. So the portals are kind of are tricksters in a way, right? They're like, oh, you want to be a hero? I'll see what you can do. You know, they're kind of, like if you wish for something, they'll give you a twist on the wish that's not the thing you wanted.
Yeah, it reminded me of the idea of like the genie, you know, where you have a genie and you wish for something, It's like you wish for $1 million and like it's like in you're but you're in a room with $1 million and you suffocate. You know, it's one of those things
right.
where it's like you really be careful what you wish for. And
yeah.
And as we learn more about the portals, we start to expand on that idea that that they're really not our friends necessarily. They're trying to do what they think is right. And, you know, we get to learn more and more about them being kind of their own entities. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to do what they think is right, maybe, but they're not necessarily our friends. And I thought that, I mean, that just posing that like that, it was pretty interesting and learning about that. And then we eventually find out that it is possible to come back, you know, that Jason comes back. And so, well, Brandon eventually goes to Marie. So these two big characters meet up. He leaves the compound, but eventually Jason comes back and it's this kind of crazy moment where Marie was sort of starting to develop feelings for Brandon. Maybe Brandon was definitely developing feelings for Marie very quickly. Uh-huh. And then all of a sudden this new person comes in, Jason, and Brandon is kind of like scoffing at him. And Marie is just like, oh my God, this is amazing. And it's like this strange, the book is already full of strange dynamics. And then it's like, okay, here's another one layered on top of that. You know, how would you imagine that for someone? You know, it's like knowing that you had perhaps come to terms with a loss through a divorce. That's one loss.
Right.
And then you had an affair. And then he went back and lost. And then that person just disappeared into a port, for example, which you could almost say is like dying.
Right.
It's almost like the person has gone forever. And then you maybe come to terms with that. And then they're back. And to me, this is just would play havoc on me. And so, I mean, how can we even think about processing terms of events like that? How is Marie managed? How is Brandon managed?
Yeah, I mean, maybe one way you manage is to act like a very petty person who's forgotten that the world has changed, like imagining Brandon being like competitive with Jason when Jason is like possibly the first person who's come back from the portals. And his first thought is like, this guy's effing with my love, you know, my love affair. Which I think to me, it's amusing that people are capable of being as petty as we are in circumstances that seem so, you know, requiring of awe or, you know, some larger emotion about the sublime. Mm-hmm. I just find that really, I think that's an adorable feature of human beings. Also sometimes obviously leads to trouble as all of our adorable traits do. And I guess, I mean, Marie, I think that it's still coming for her, you know, it ends before she really has to face all of what has happened and really face what happened with Jason. Even facing what she's done, which is to allow herself to be connected to somebody who is willing to start a family with someone else, is willing to lie to those people, lie to his new wife. So I think that the book ends before we can really get into what the real fallout would be for her.
Yeah. Well, that's why there'll be a sequel, I hope.
Yeah, maybe.
But yeah, I think that's a great point. And, so then we start to get into the last part of the book was really fascinating for me. I mean, we start to get into Jason retelling his story a bit of what happened to him personally and then what happens inside the port. So then this is our second look inside a port, and it's completely different than what Philippe had. You know, Philippe had this sort of realistic environment where he was in this world and it was sort of just like he went back in time, but he was still on Earth kind of.
Right.
And then Jason just has this like long, what is it?
Boardwalk to nowhere.
Boardwalk or whatever. Yeah. He just has a long boardwalk to nowhere, which is like the ultimate nightmare, I think, probably, where you're just running and nothing's changing and you're just like, oh my gosh. And then this sort of apparition comes and starts talking to him and sort of represents the ports. So at that point, what were the ports to you?
So first of all, one thing that I thought was like in terms of the be careful what you wish for with Jason, the fact that he ends up there is partly because the thing he most longs for is like the knowledge of the universe. So he's this physicist philosopher. And so part of it was them just being like, well, here you go, and freaking him out. But I think I have this idea that they're these ancient kind of life forms that that were disembodied, so they like had somehow existed always, but had no means by which to physically do anything. They didn't have bodies. They didn't have. They weren't together. And the technology that Doors, some other technology that Doors invented, allowed them to sort of, I would say, infiltrate him and like and make it possible for him to make the technology he thinks is he's making on his own. But actually, they're helping convince him to do that through whatever means they have, which is more like a viral kind of a means or like a hive mind.
Yeah.
So I haven't decided whether I think those are alien, an ancient alien life form, or some kind of other god. I don't know. But yeah, they're definitely not just technology. They're not just technological.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. And so yeah, we sort of the wrap up or postlude that you wrote. I just also wanted to throw in there. I thought was quite beautiful and really interesting and. I don't, it's one of those things where I'm going to have to read like 10 times and try and process and think through. But, it's interesting to me that the way you kind of wrote the ending, the way you wrap things up, like you said, where there it wasn't going to be super clean. There's still hope. It's not clear what's happening. We had all these pockets, you know, we have the pocket in Silicon Valley. We had the Portland people we visited, you know, we had, the cross country drive. We had, you know, these, and then we had everyone meeting up, Brandon and Marie and Jason all over again. So it's sort of like, okay, well, this is the reality and we're going to just going to, you know, work through it. And the ports mentioned that, you know, we're giving all these people a new chance and we're giving the Earth a new chance. And like in their minds, they're sort of hitting the reset button for us all. And, you know, you're welcome.
Right.
So kind of wrapping things up along those lines, is there anything else that you hoped people would get out of the story or ideas that you wanted to pass along that we haven't really covered yet?
Well, one thing I'll say is that, I mean, the ending has been divisive because some people really hate that postlude and other people really love it. And one of the people who really loves it is my father. So my dad, so I was raised in a very, in a Calvinist Christian upbringing. I don't know if you know much about Calvinism, but I was raised in a very devout, but also like highly intellectual community, where the theology is pretty well worked out and pretty intense, actually. And my dad, who has been a devout Christian all his life, or most of his life, he wrote a thesis when I was growing up for a master's degree in education called "Is Technology a Threat to Education?" And it was only after I wrote this book that I realized how influenced I had been by his ideas, which at the time, you know, as I was growing up, I was very resistant to his ideas. I thought they were old-fashioned. I thought, like, why are you so scared of technology? You know, we didn't have a microwave. We didn't have a TV for a long time. We didn't have a VCR. We had all these beliefs. And my dad sort of said, like, he was very delighted by this idea that, like, humans and their hubris were going to be taken down by their own sort of devices. And so the one thing I'll just say is that, like, sometimes you write a book and you don't even know that you've been influenced for years by something, which feels very appropriate considering that you know, we're all influenced by these things in ways that we can't control. So
it's funny, but as I was reading this, I actually, and I'm thinking about the ports, I actually thought about the idea of kind of common trope of the book you can't put down.
Right.
You know, to some degree that we get, but books take us into another world often, and we can then love that so much that we become addicted to that other world and we want to read the book and we can't put it down. And I don't know, I just felt like there was some interesting connection there somehow. But
well, totally, because I was writing this thing about, like, we need to be more present, we need to, like, pay attention to what's around us, but also I love to be in my imagination and I love to be in imaginary worlds, and I'm not giving that up and I'm not apologizing for it. So for whatever that's
totally worth. Agreed. Okay. No, 100% with you. So I like to read so much.
Right.
Cool. All right. Well, so is there anything else that you are working on or putting together, or, you know, kind of what's on your mind at this stage of your life?
Well, I'm sort of in an editing stage with my next novel, which is a completely different novel. I've been calling it for a couple of years, I've been calling it my doomed sex novel. It's like a fast-paced novel of erotic gothic doom. So,
wow. Okay.
It's
great adjectives.
Yeah, it's got like a, I mean, it's got a lot of taboo sex, a lot of problematic sex, a lot of ambiguous moral problems. So anyway, very tragic, very intense book, totally different. And I'm pretty happy with that. So I'm hoping that will be out not too long. And I'm also working on a memoir. I was mentioning the mental health crisis that I went through when I was 17. And I've written a memoir about it called Interpretation Machine that I'm finishing, and I'm in an editing stage with that as well. So those are my two big projects that I'm working on right now.
Wow. Those are big. Well, that's exciting.
Yeah.
I look forward to checking those out. I am interested in both. In their own way. So, okay, but let's finish up with a thunder round, some quick getting to know you questions, and we will call it a day. Okay?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay, what is your favorite food and or drink?
I think my favorite drink is champagne. And my favorite food is probably chocolate. I think those are probably explain a lot about me. So just all celebration. Well, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, they go well together even. So
yeah.
Good. I like that.
Not healthy.
Okay. Where's your, there are worse. There are worse things. Where is your favorite place you've ever been?
I feel like I need to say that my favorite place is my hometown of Hamilton, Ontario, which is probably not many people's favorite place because it's not glamorous, but I love it there. So that was a place that I loved living and growing up and coming of age and falling in love. I think my another place that I love is the Adirondacks in New York State, where I spent a lot of time as a kid because my grandparents had a trailer there. But yeah, I'll say Hamilton, Ontario. Shout out to my hometown.
Sounds good. And last question, if you could wave a magic wand and change any one thing, what would it be and why?
Well, I don't know how I could answer anything other than changing the environmental catastrophe. I wish that we could turn back to a moment when we had an option not to go so far with fossil fuels and just chose a different energy source and changed the way we lived at a crucial moment, maybe 20, 30 years ago. That would be my magic wand.
All right. Fair answer.
Yeah.
Well, Liz, thanks so much for talking with me. This was really interesting and really great. We dived into so much, I think, both about the book and the world today. Mm-hmm. And I think everyone listening, if this hasn't clued you in, the book is absolutely fascinating. There's so much more to it even than we talked about, from road trips with chickens and all the more. And so, yeah, the book again, The Amateurs. Liz Harmer, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you so much, John.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Read, Learn, Live. If you liked it, tell a friend and subscribe on iTunes and Google Play. If you hated it, tell a friend and subscribe on iTunes and Google Play. And so it goes.